The most trusted and longest-running sports talk show in Tennessee. From the Budweiser studios of Cumulus Broadcasting, this is Sports Talk with John Wilkerson and Jimmy Hines on Sports Radio WNML.
Welcome back to Sports Talk. I'm Jimmy Hines along with Vince Ferrar. We had a chance to catch up with Rick Byrd yesterday. Rick Byrd is from South Knoxville. His dad, of course, was Hall of Fame sports writer Ben Byrd. And Rick coached at a couple of places. He was at Belmont for a long time. He recently had the court at Belmont named after him. Much deserved. He is among the top 20 all-time in victories in college basketball. And did an outstanding job for so many years at Belmont. Spoke to the Big Orange Tip-Off Club yesterday. Here's our one-on-one conversation with Rick Byrd.
Rick, your dad was, of course, an outstanding sports writer for many, many years. And I wonder, was there anything from him that you learned that helped you be a basketball coach?
Oh, gosh. So much of what I learned from him was just about being a man, being a person that with humility. Because he was about as humble as anybody I've ever known. I think his overall philosophy about college athletics in particular was that it's a game, and that's the way he treated it. And I've tried to remember that as I coach teams, that one of the things I would tell kids in recruiting and their parents was, if you come here and it's not enjoyable, if it's not fun to play basketball for us, then I'm not doing my job. Mm-hmm. So I just think he always looked at it that way. And he didn't suffer bullies very much. I can still remember we went to the banquet one year and Bobby Knight spoke early in his career at Indiana. And he was a friend of Coach Mears, Bobby Knight was. And he got up, and of course he ran down sports writers and officials and women in general. And so at the end of my dad's little story about the banquet, he said, Bob Knight, head coach in Indiana, was last night's speaker. In the past, there's been some very good speakers at this banquet, but last night was not one of them. So I don't know if you get away with that today or not, but he didn't like that kind of personality. He didn't like guys that boasted about themselves, thought they were self-important.
You had the basketball court named after you at Belmont Saturday. What did that mean to you?
Well, everything. I mean, whatever might come your way after a long career where you win a few games and maybe some championships, you're going to have nice honors, but 33 years in one place, and to feel like that it was more than just winning games is why they did it, at least the way they presented it. It was a wonderful ceremony that Belmont did a great job with, and I get pretty emotional. It was tough to get through what I had to say because that school means so much to me, and the kids that played for me meant so much to me.
You had great success, and I wonder how tempted were you to test your skills at a higher level, but at the same time, is there some gratitude that you stayed at one place for that many years?
Oh, I think there's about 99%. The 1% might be cash on hand. I don't know. By the time that maybe my resume said this guy could coach with some guys at the power conference level, I was mid to late 50s and felt so good about the culture around our basketball program, the kind of young men that we could recruit, the success we were having. Nothing's ever on autopilot, but I just didn't feel like at that age that I needed to take on a whole new. If I was going to get a job, it's probably because somebody wasn't doing very good and the program wasn't in very good shape, and that starts a whole nother. And particularly for me, I'm old school dinosaur-like in standards and beliefs, and it would probably be a culture change in a big way for a lot of places. So I'm very happy that it turned out the way it did. You know, I coached against some of the best and probably lost more than one against the power conferences, but we won our share, and I feel okay about how I could stack up.
You coached against a player, Ja Morant, that is tearing it up in the NBA. He's a favorite right now to be the rookie of the year in the NBA. What do you remember about his recruitment, if at all, and what do you recall about his progress at Murray State?
Well, I didn't know anything about him, and neither did Murray State. They went to see another kid on that ended up being still playing for them now. It's a junior, a really good player. And it was in some back gym, and they just kept noticing Ja Morant. And then his freshman year, he wasn't even freshman of the year in the OVC. He was Terry Taylor at Austin Peay, who's a great player, got that honor because Ja was sort of a second choice. In fact, our scouting report was go under ball screens, let him shoot all threes he wants to shoot. And I'm so bad with names, but when their star guard left after the senior year and they had one every year, so that's why I can't remember all their names. And we kept hearing in the offseason that all the NBA scouts were showing up and going and watching him and all that kind of stuff, and we didn't get it. But we got it, by watching him last year. We got lucky and on a really big night on the ESPN nationally televised game at their place. He tweaked his ankle. We managed to beat those guys there, but they got us back in the championship game. I'm pretty amazed at his immediate success because he's not a big, strong kid. I wondered if he could finish against the size in the NBA. But I have never coached against anybody that found teammates and delivered passes in the right place at the right time like he does.
When did you realize he was a special talent?
I think in scouting their games for his sophomore season, you're so wrapped up in your own team, and you've got 20 games before you play a conference opponent. So we would see things, hear things, but I didn't look at Murray State till it was time for us to play Murray State really, and so watching him play three or four games on video, I got it, and he was so hard to keep in front of you. So hard. And then when he got by you, if you helped too quick, he found the guy. And if you didn't help, he scored. And he's an exciting guy to watch play.
How unusual is his story, though? You don't always see people just jump to the top like that were so under-recruited coming out of high school.
No, you don't. You just said it. It's real, real, real odd that this happened. But it does go. There's still guys out there. I mean, we had a first round draft choice too, and Dylan Windler. Well, Dylan Windler was totally under recruited until he blew up in the summer prior to his senior year, and we'd already been in and seen him and on the ground floor, and we were able to get him. But he almost flew completely under the radar. And here's a guy that turns into a first round pick.
That's Rick Byrd, former Belmont coach, speaking at the Big Orange Tip-Off Club. He is in the Greater Knoxville Sports Hall of Fame. I really enjoyed the visit with him, but I remember talking to him a couple of years ago when he was still at Belmont, and there was all this buzz about Ja Morant. And as he said in the interview, he said, well, yeah, we played against him when he was a freshman, and he wasn't all that great. Then the next year, yes, he was.
It's fun. It's funny, Jimmy, because I've been with you when we've had Rick Byrd on the show. Might have been either just before he retired or just after he retired. He had him on the show. And I've always felt like every time I've heard him on with you in that time that he hasn't been overwhelmed by Ja Morant. I think that's been a kind of pretty consistent thing. Maybe he doesn't see him as fundamental or whatever, but there's no question about it. In the NBA, for what they do, he's spectacular. And to me, he's a no-brainer rookie of the year.
Yeah, Now, Byrd did grow to appreciate
sure.
Morant, but initially it was like, right. I don't get this.
And I thought it was interesting, too. He threw Murray under the bus, too.
Well, they didn't know either.
Right. It's like, well, don't give him any recruiting credit for that. They stumbled across him. Interesting.
Yeah. And you rarely see – I've got to think, just off the top of my head, I've got to think the same thing probably happened with Scottie Pippen. Where did he play? If I remember right, Arkansas Pine Bluff.
Right.
How in the world did he wind up at Arkansas Pine Bluff? Unless people didn't see him as being that good coming out of high school, probably.
Guys develop at different rates.
They do.
So.
They do. Some develop when they're 12, some when they're 22, and then a whole bunch in between. Yeah. So you never really know. One other thing Rick said, and he said, I know I'm in the minority on this. He was asked about paying college players, and he doesn't agree with it. He said he believes the value of a scholarship is significant, and he also said that cost of attendance is helpful to him. He hasn't seen a plan that he likes. He thinks it's opening a Pandora's box about how do you do it. And on the name, image, and likeness, his concern, and others I've talked to about it too, they're like, okay, certain segment are going to get money, others won't. Is there jealousy that's going to creep in within the roster about that? I don't know. I'm not a big fan of it because I haven't seen a plan that I think works. But I do know this. If you start doing that, they're going to have to file some income tax for their proceeds. And somebody said, well, you need to cap it. How do you cap it? You remember the restricted earnings coaches they had in men's basketball?
Right.
Well, they lost a lawsuit over that one. So I don't think you could put a cap on it. It's going to be interesting to see where this goes. I do think they will adopt name, image, and likeness. But if you pay players, then how much and who? Do you pay them all? Do you pay only revenue-producing sports? If you try to go that route and pay men's basketball, then women's basketball is going to say Title IX. So it's going to be interesting to see where that goes.
There's no clear, easy solution to it, obviously. Yeah. And, you know, as typically is the case, there's unintended consequences that we're not even thinking about. But are there other things that maybe can play out differently than what they look like on the surface? I mean, look at the early signing period, Jimmy. That early signing period, even though people are adjusting, I mean, it makes it really hard for people to turn around their programs. And then you have more and more kids that are wanting out quickly because coaches leave after they're signed and, you know, to a national letter of intent. Because mm-hmm. the coaches are holding on, getting them to that school, and then they're going elsewhere. And then those kids are like, okay, now things are going to change. Now I'm here stuck at the school. I think that's another reason why you're seeing the movement towards getting that at least the minimum one basically free transfer that the more conferences are starting to push for, because they didn't really look at some of those unintended consequences of the transfer portal. Now is going to be used a lot more because of the movement of coaches in that early signing period.
Sometimes you can, if you're a midterm enrollee and then you enroll, you're stuck. And then the coach that recruited you leaves.
Right.
Or the head coach leaves. So there's that part of it. At least if you know in December, sometimes if in December, if a coach leaves, you can get out of it. I did ask Philip Former about the one transfer, and he wasn't sold on that idea. His thinking? There are a lot of kids their freshman year that want to leave because they're homesick or they don't fit in or they're not starting or they're fourth team. And he said, now you're just inviting a whole lot of more, a lot more people to transfer without trying to stick it out.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't, I can see that argument too.
Oh yeah.
On that side that there are a lot of people, I'm sure, that he coached at Tennessee that wanted to leave their freshman year and were persuaded not to, perhaps because they wanted to sit out a year, and then they became really good players. So That was his side of the argument, which I can see that too. So I'm not sure that's a great solution either.
Well, and then you think, all right, can you force them to wait a year? I don't think they would do that, put any sort of limitation on it to where you have to be there a certain period of time. I wouldn't see them putting that on them, because then what if you have to have exceptions on that? Because what if there's a coaching change?
Right.
You know, so. It's just really difficult either way.
It is. Hey, when we come back, let's hear from Mike Swartz. He's associate head coach for the Tennessee Vols. We had a chance to catch up with some of his comments at the Big Orange Tip-Off Club. With Vince Ferrar, I'm Jimmy Himes. Sports Talk, 99.1 The Sports Animal.
In your car, in your office, in your house, in your shower. 99.1 The Sports Animal. Pass the body wash.
Welcome back to Sports Talk. I'm Jimmy Himes with Vince Ferrar. Let's hear now from Mike Swartz, associate head coach, Tennessee basketball. And Tennessee has split its last two games, had a great chance to beat South Carolina, but turnovers were the culprit late in that game. And then against Vanderbilt, they led by 12 with about a minute left, and it got down to two, and they barely pulled that one out. Turnovers have been an issue late. Turnovers have been an overall issue as well. Mike Swartz talks about that problem.
You know, a lot of people have talked about that last shot in South Carolina, and the reality is it should never have came to that. And that's the as good of a play as that was for Josiah to be able to execute that play and throw the ball off the left side of the rim and chase it down, focus and keep it. That's good and dandy, but it should never have come to that play. And that was the frustrating part for us. And looking at where we are right now as a team, there's one Achilles heel. And, you know, in athletics, there's always going to be an Achilles heel for every team. There's going to be something that you have some kind of – something with your team you have to find a way to come get better at, find a way to solve that issue. And the issue we're having with this team is turnovers. That is an issue. We're averaging 17.5 turnovers over the last two games. And an even more stat that has challenged us and cost us Saturday and really, this could really be a somber meeting for us in here today if it had cost us last night, was the fact that we've had 7 turnovers in the final 3 minutes of the last two games combined. So if you look at the last 3 minutes of the last two games, a minute and 50 in Columbia and the last minute last night, so 2 minutes and 50 seconds, we have a combined 7 turnovers in that time span. And that's not good enough. And we know that, and our players know that, and obviously, that's where a lot of the frustration from Coach Barnes and our coaching staff came from last night at the end of the ballgame. And we have to find a way to be able to still stay aggressive on offense. We have to find a way, you know, not shooting the ball as well as we have the past 2 years. It's definitely that has contributed to that, because anytime you don't shoot the basketball well, things get a little bit tighter. You start looking for maybe you got to have a good shot. You're looking for maybe a better shot, and sometimes that better shot consists of a difficult pass, trying to put the ball in a tight space, and that happened a little bit last night. One that comes to mind, if you Vanderbilt goes zone, Eve Pons flashes to the middle of the free throw line to the high post. He's a terrific shooter in that area. He's a terrific, I mean, he shoots probably 60, 70, 80% in that spot on the floor. And he tries to make a very difficult pass into Olivier on the block, turns into a turnover, they go the other way, and they score. So those kind of things start to accumulate over a game, and that's just what we're dealing with as a team. And so the question would be, why are we dealing with that? What is, you know, well, a big reason is what we've gone through at the point guard spot, and I'm sure Kim English and Desmond Oliver and Coach Barnes, when they've been here, they've talked about it. But we started the year with one point guard. He had to, you know, call it a season come December. We had another point guard. He's been injured. Another point guard comes from another country and has 3 days of practice, and now he plays. And this has just been a cumulative effect. And it does start with the point guard, and by no means is it all on the point guard, but that's always going to be the head of the snake. That's always going to be the tip of the spear, the one that allows to say, hey, this is really the flow of our offense. This is everybody is in rhythm or we're not. We're cohesive or we're a little bit, you know, or we're not. And we've been a little jumbled the last couple of games. Again, 20 turnovers for South Carolina and 15 last night. And we know we have to be a lot better in that area. But the good thing is, and we said this, that maybe we have not been able to fully click on that side of the ball yet, but we know why. We've had subtractions, additions. You know, Urosh has come in, and that was a big deal. That was an emotional part of our team for the first half of the season. He became eligible. So trying to find those rotations, trying to find that unit that really can be cohesive has been a challenge. But the good thing is we still have 6 guaranteed games left. You know, we told the guys last night, you have 6 conference games and 1 SEC tournament game that we have guaranteed left. And now we got a win last night. We're still guaranteed 6, 5 regular season games and 1 conference tournament game. So there's still time to hit that point. And with someone like Santi or someone like Urosh, they didn't get Eastern New Mexico. They didn't get that game. They didn't get the games that we had early in the season in Florida where we struggled with some of those things, but they had an opportunity versus a Florida State or a VCU to say, okay, hey, this is what it's like at this level. So those are things we're still hopefully trending in the right direction, and we can hit that point. So turnovers is really it, and that's really the thing that we focused on. Again, it's hard to focus on, hey, we're not making shots. And we know, I mean, the reality is last night we opened the game up, and as well as John Folkerson played in the first half, he'd be the first to come in and say, and he said his halftime, he played that poorly in the first half, shooting as well as he played in the second half, that he struggled in the first half. And we open up the game, we get the exact shot we want at the rim. It was a scripted play, and John has the ball at the rim, and it doesn't go in. And for a team that sometimes can be a little fragile in terms of shooting the basketball and that ball going through the net, that can also set the tone a little bit. And then Jordan Bowden, who has struggled a little bit shooting the ball at home, as we know, his numbers are stronger on the road, he gets a first look from the corner, and it doesn't draw iron. But slowly but surely, that stuff started to change, and those guys, Bowden had a good game, and John bounced back in the second half. But really, what it comes down to for us and where we are as a team right now is we got to find a way to secure the ball better. And if we secure the ball better, we feel very confident in what the guys are doing on offense. We feel very confident in what they're doing on defense and our ability to keep the game where we want to keep it. And, again, back to the opening statement is Saturday's game should never have come down to that, having to miss a free throw on purpose. I mean, we should have walked out of there. We feel like we had a six-point lead with 3 minutes and 50 seconds left. And we were leading with under a minute to go, and we didn't take care of what we needed to. But that's also what a youthful team and a team with some inexperience has to go through.
Tennessee signed two football players, Malachi Wideman and Dee Beckwith, who also want to play basketball. Schwartz was asked about that possibility.
You know, I think those are things that we're open to it. I know Coach Pruitt and his staff, they're open to it. A lot of time that stuff doesn't matriculate until they get to campus, till you can see how it would work and they can feel what football's like and they know what the season feels like to be playing in spring football and practice and summer and their season, and then we're in the middle. So all those things that stuff more happens when they get to campus, but absolutely, Coach Barnes is really excited about them. They're fantastic athletes. We had a chance to meet them when they were on their visit, so we'll see how that happens, but we'd love to have them.
That's Vols Associate Head Coach Mike Schwartz. When we come back, we'll be joined by Mike Murray of the Knoxville Ice Bears. With Vince Ferrar, I'm Jimmy Himes. Sports Talk, FM 99.1, the sports animal.
The circle across, Price back to a run in front, they score!
Joel Silverberg's call of the Ice Bears. How about that? Please now to be joined by the general manager of the Ice Bears, and that is Mike Murray. Mike, how you doing?
Good, guys. How are you today?
Doing fantastic. What did you think of Joel's call there?
I mean, you know, he's from you guys. We got him right out of the studio there. He did such a great job for us. Not a lot of fans get to hear how emotional he gets on our broadcast, so it was kind of nice to for our social media team to repost that on our Instagram, and so many of our fans were like, how do I get to hear that? So, you know, I can't appreciate Joel enough, just to show the emotion. I know my parents listen back home on the broadcast, and obviously there's nothing better for, you know, to see a sold out crowd rise to their feet at the same time. It never gets old from a front office or ownership's perspective, just to see that happen, 5,000 people at the same time. It's amazing. It's something that kind of gives you chills as an owner. And obviously it's great for the guys just to see everybody, you know, leave the building so happy.
Team's rolling pretty well right now, Mike. What's been the key?
Well, you know, we talked a couple weeks ago about how we lost four in a row and how we got pushed around in our own building. And that just doesn't sit well with any of us. So Jeff made a couple changes on the back end, added some toughness, and the guys have kind of stepped up. And like I said, if you're, whether you're an employee in an office setting or you're on a professional hockey team, if you're sitting next to the same guy for the longest time all year, and then all of a sudden he's not there because the team's not doing well. And he was, the hostage kind of thing. You kind of have to, you know, step up or step out. And, you know, a lot of guys take pride in wearing the Knoxville Ice Bears crest on the front of their jerseys, and they really appreciate the fan base and everything that is supportive around this community. And if you don't play well enough to be here, You're just simply not. And so we make those two changes, and guys start rolling. We start playing better, playing tougher at home, and it's definitely shown.
Well, you guys did make some moves, but the trade deadline, I guess, is looming. What does that look like for you and you guys where you sit right now after the most recent changes?
Well, you know, we still have, and we just had a guy called up, Anthony McVeigh got called up. He's supposed to be back, but you know how that goes. So that would make six of our players called up to the next level, which is amazing. It's great. You know, we want them to get the opportunities that that Jeff kind of promised they would in his recruiting efforts. But we're looking for. It's kind of a bittersweet date. February 29th is the ECHL loan cutoff date, where if a player gets called up after that date, he cannot come back to our team. He can't come back to the league. So, you know, it has to be a for sure thing. And obviously there's a lot of conversation at that point. But the ECHL is very aware of that, and to the point where, you know, we put that rule in place for a reason, and it's simply just because as all of our teams head down the stretch, we need to know what we're going to go into battle with in the postseason. And so that's February 29th date for the cutoff date for the ECHL call-ups is in place, and the trade deadline is March 2nd. So, you know, any puzzle pieces that we feel need to be adjusted, if we know we're getting guys back or we're not getting guys back, then we need to make a trade. We'll pull the trigger. It's not like it's you're inheriting a 3 or 4 year contract. These guys are under a contract for 1 year, so it's all or nothing down the stretch. So there's a lot of meetings and conversations that go in with myself and Jeff and our assistant coach Spencer Metcalf about the pieces of the puzzle we need to have going in the battle to represent our town.
Mike, the anniversary of the Miracle on Ice is upon us, and I wonder, what do you remember about that from 1980?
I mean, yeah, tomorrow marks 40 years of that date. And obviously, as a Canadian kid sitting on the couch with my dad watching that, obviously that's what I remember the most. Obviously, you know, I was probably a couple of years away from that point of moving away from home, being drafted into junior hockey, and, you know, unbeknownst to me how critical that was going to be in my life. But I mean, sitting there on the couch with my dad watching that, as a Canadian kid, I didn't realize the magnitude that it had for the country. I mean, obviously as a hockey person, as a hockey fan, to see them upset, you know, the giants of the hockey world at that time, I didn't realize personally at that time, I think I was maybe 13 years old, of the magnitude of what it did for the country of the United States. And, even to sit back and watch the NHL Network now and just see the stories that came from that and what it did to the country and kind of rallied the country was pretty amazing. Like I said, I didn't know the magnitude back then, but as I've grown and as I turned 19, I signed with the Philadelphia Flyers, and I've been in the States since I was 19. Just to hear the stories over the years have been absolutely incredible.
Well, the Russia team, that was actually in the semifinals. Some people forget that. The U.S. still had to go beat Finland, I think it was. But I don't recall the exact score, but in an exhibition, Russia beat the Americans like 12-2. It wasn't even a contest.
Yeah, I think they played them in New York 2 weeks earlier, and everybody thought it was just going to be a joke, but you know, the guys, and the great thing about it, a lot of people don't know this, is those guys were not professional hockey players. They were college.
The U.S. team, yeah.
Yeah, the U.S. team, sorry. And, so for that, Herb Brooks, I mean, some of his press conferences, when I look back on some of those stories and seeing how he absolutely just bashed his own team. He said, we're not good enough to be on the same ice as those guys. And just the mental approach that he took to get his players to get motivated to rally for each other was a big part of why they won.
Mike, NDC did great work with Hockey Night in America. What'd you think of their coverage? And it even included Nashville and talking about the Nashville Sled Preds and the really highlighted the community. What'd you make of that?
I think it's amazing. Obviously, you know, from what we do here in Knoxville, Tennessee, to share our sport. I mean, Hockey Day in America is it's amazing. I mean, I don't know the exact number, but I mean, it was obviously the whole country of Canada stopped the day that Wayne Gretzky was traded to the LA Kings. I remember sitting there watching that too. I was just came back from my training workout or whatever, and everybody's in front of the TV watching Wayne Gretzky cry, and you know that he got traded to LA. But there's a number, and I'm not sure what the exact number is, of the amount of hockey arenas that have been built in Southern California as a result since Wayne Gretzky went there. And to see like guys like Austin Matthews, that's the leading goal scorer of the NHL right now, came from California. It's amazing how, and I tell the story too, as a Canadian, obviously you want to brag on Canada about how Canadian hockey players are this or that, but two of the guys that I played against and played with were two of the fastest skaters I'd ever seen during my time of playing, and one was Pat LaFontaine and the other one was Mike Modano. I'd never seen guys skate that fast in my life, and both of those guys at that time obviously were American-born players. It just seemed like they floated on air, and it was amazing to watch them. But, to live in the States for as long as I have and just got my American citizenship a year and a half ago, and to be a part of the, hockey landscape and obviously, just down the road from the Preds, to be acknowledged like that, it's great to be a part of. I love sharing our, the sport that I grew up loving so much with people that, aren't so familiar with it. And we can educate around it. Yeah, we boast about all the promotions we do about the game to get people to the rink. But at the end of the day, it's an amazing sport. It's high intensity. It's all the things that you could ever ask for. And I think NBC has done a great job of sharing that ever since the 1980 Olympics.
Mike, tell us about Nautical Night.
Nautical Night, obviously. We're slowly transitioning out of the January, February into the spring. And obviously MasterCraft has partnered with us to have some boats on display at the arena on Saturday night. And obviously with boating comes tubing, and our promotion on the ice is going to be tube racing. So you've seen us do dinosaur racing, you've seen us do baby racing, you've seen us do wiener dog racing. Now we're doing tube racing. So It's obviously anytime we put race behind anything around this town, it's amazing the people that show up and want to see it. So it's obviously, I looked at the numbers this morning. The numbers are great for our Saturday night crowd. I can't thank Knoxville enough for supporting what we do. We've been averaging over 4,500 in the 5,000 seat arena for the last probably five or six, seven games. So it's been great, and we look forward to it. It's only we only play at home this Saturday night, only this week, so and then one again next week. So our crowds will still be, hungry for hockey, if you will. And, couldn't be, we're headed down the stretch right now. We only have seven home games left before the postseason, and hopefully to bring Knoxville its fifth title.
I have been out of pocket a little while. Did you have a capacity crowd for Wiener Dog Race Night?
Yeah, we sold out for Wiener Dog Race. I was very impressed for Valentine's Day. We were, a little cautious about having that date chosen. It was either going to take that date or have to be stuck with a Tuesday or a Thursday, so we took it. And I was amazed that we had 3,200 people in the building for Valentine's night, and then we turned around for Star Wars and sold the building out for Star Wars night, too. So it's, like I said, people are looking for great entertainment, and for 2.5 hours for as low as $18, I don't know anywhere else you're going to get that. Our production team is doing such a great job with the entertainment aspect of that Jumbotron or that video board, and it just makes it all worthwhile. And it's we're going to keep growing from it as a result with more and more corporate partners.
Hey, Mike, we appreciate it. Thanks for joining us, and good luck this weekend.
Guys, thanks so much for having us. You guys have a great weekend as well, and hopefully we'll bring home another two wins this weekend.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks so much.
Mike Murray, general manager of the Ice Bears. He joins us on the Stanley Fence and Gates hotline. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the negotiating points with the NFL's CBA. With Vince Ferrara and Jimmy Himes, Sports Talk 99.1, The Sports Animal.
Download the TuneIn app so you can take 99.1 The Sports Animal with you wherever you go.
Welcome back to Sports Talk. I'm Jimmy Himes along with Vince Ferrara. The NFL is negotiating a deal with the football players, NFLPA, and they've got a – here are some of the proposals. We've all heard about the potential to go to 17 games. Also, with the playoff format, adding one team to each conference so that at wild card weekend, you would have three games, three playoff games Saturday, three on Sunday. The only bye would go to a number one seed. Vince, do you like that?
You know what? I'm kind of torn on it. I'm mixed on it. I see there's positive and there's negatives. I don't hate it. I don't love it. Yes, it brings you extra football, but there's also a chance that you're going to see mediocre teams slide into the playoffs. I think a number of years there would be 8-8 football teams that would make it. And some years there's a team with a really good record that is almost as pretty much as good as someone that does get in that maybe is on the outside looking in based on a tiebreaker. So each year is going to be a little bit different. I'm not as much of a fan that the number two seed now will have to play that first weekend. Because usually those are really good teams. Sometimes you can get a 14-2 and a 13-3, or a 13-3 and a 12-4. And
Kansas City won the Super Bowl as a two seed, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, so they would have to play now that extra game. And teams that have byes, Super Bowl champions, normally come from those group of teams. Now you're making it more difficult for the you know, a really good team to make it. So there's definitely drawbacks. It's also going to add to more teams are going to be in the mix till later in the year, so fans are still going to feel like they've got a shot to make the playoffs and still be invested. So there's certainly some positives to it.
When I first heard it, I didn't like it. I thought, hey, six is enough. I like the way they do it. They've been doing this for 30 years. It works. And then there was a part of me that thought, well, you know what? I will get to see three playoff games Saturday and three on Sunday. Mm-hmm. So more football, more enjoyable for me. So I'm thinking, hey, that's not bad. But then the flip side, I don't necessarily like the two seeds having to play, which they would have to do, as you talked about. So I'm a little bit split on this one in regard to that. I think that what they've had has worked, and it's been that way for 30 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of take it or leave it. I wouldn't be upset about it or bothered by it. Same with the 17 games. I could see the players talking about safety. However, here's the caveat. The revenue sharing would go from 47% for the players to 48.5%. That's $5 billion, not million, $5 billion more for players. Do you think that gets their attention enough to where they will agree to go to 17 games?
Well, It sounds like they wanted more than that, but the NFL released a statement today that they voted today to accept the negotiated terms of on the principal elements of the new collective bargaining agreement. The Players Association also needs to vote on it to approve the same term. So I guess the NFL statement is saying, hey, we've agreed on what we want the CBA to be. Now the players have to agree to it. I think it's still expected that they're going to come to a agreement very soon. They need to. When you're talking that kind of money, you would think that would be good enough. I want them to increase the rosters. That's going to be especially if 17 games is going to be a part of the deal. I think in enhanced rosters is for each of those NFL teams and more players active has got to be a part of that. And maybe now you're paying more players as opposed to playing the current players more money. If as long as it's distributed into more jobs and that money is going towards additional players on your roster, then I think that's good. But You know how it is. The pie often goes to the
quarterbacks.
To the quarterbacks and the guys that are already getting paid the most money.
So it's 53 right now, right?
On the roster. Yes.
Would you go to 56, 58? What's your thinking there?
Well, I would go at least 56 and then make everybody active for game day. Because you usually have 7-8 inactives. Mm-hmm. So why? That they're preparing for your team. Why? What travel costs? Sorry, you're so poor, and you have to budget to pay to travel with a few extra players. they print money. I don't want to hear that nonsense.
Is that why they do it? Because of travel? Or you're speculating?
No, I'm just speculating. I'm just saying, whatever the reason, I don't think it's good enough.
You know,
just,
they didn't have a good enough reason for Vince Ferrar.
It's not good enough. Yeah. So that's a way. So then you're basically adding, gosh, I want to say 8 to 10 players active. And if they are going to say, all right, we're going to 17-game schedule and only players can only play 16. If they were to do something like that to where we're expanding the schedule, but the players don't have to play an extra game. You'll have to, everybody's got to sit out one game or however. I think it's going to be difficult to manage.
Yeah, because you're not going to be able to sit out a quarterback, right?
Well, then when do you do it? Do you do it?
You don't.
Right.
For a quarterback.
And
probably for a lot of other star players, too.
Yeah, I don't know.
A lot of them, they don't want to pass up on that game check now.
Well, here's what they're doing for the playoff. You're right, for the game check, that's one thing. And some players, if you're going to pay them for a 17th game, they'd be fine with the 17th game. But others are like, no, I don't care. This is going to shorten my career, and you know I'm going to get beat up. And then what about me, my health for the playoffs, that kind of thing? But for the playoffs, for the team that get, for anyone that gets a bye, they will get a game check like normal as if they played that weekend. That is part of this agreement.
That's a bonus for being a one seed. Yeah.
Right. So it's you're not discouraged. They're not feeling like, hey, yeah, I'd almost kind of rather play and get paid than sit out and not play. You still, it ends up being a real incentive to be that one seed.
That's Vince Ferrar. When we come back, we'll be joined by Brent Hubbs of VolQuest.com. This is Sports Talk, FM 99.1, The Sports Animal.